Right. So I'm going to start today with some general information about the Supreme Court and the 2018 term, which ended on June 27th. And then I'm going to discuss three specific cases. The first, a religion case involving a 40-foot tall war memorial whose dominant feature is a 32-foot cross and located on government property in Maryland. And next, I'm going to talk about the partisan gerrymandering case that the court decided this year. And finally, the dispute over the citizenship question on the United States census. Time allowing, I'll give you a few general takeaways from the term and also a description of some of the cases that the court has on its docket for next term, which is likely to be a fairly explosive term already. So first, some general information. I provided a handout. If anyone doesn't have it, there are some additional copies back there. Because the room has no technology, so we're going old school. And this is a display of the Supreme Court justices in various ways, first by age, and you see that Justice Ginsburg is the oldest member of the court in 86. And then the baby of the court, Neil Gorsuch, 51 years old, and the rankings in between. Age seems terribly relevant with the court because issues of longevity of the more liberal justices have obviously been much discussed. Then the next row has to do with the justices by length of service. And we start with Justice Clarence Thomas, who's been on the court since 1991. He's the remaining justice that was appointed by George H.W. Bush. And then when Bill Clinton became president, he appointed two members of the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1993 and Stephen Breyer in 1994. Then we have a gap of 11 years, at which point George W. Bush made two appointments to the court, the Chief Justice in 2005 and Samuel Alito in 2006. Then another gap and another president, and we had Obama's two nominees to the court, Elena Kagan in 2009 and Sonia Sotomayor in 2010. And then, of course, we have another break, and the two most recent appointees, Neil Gorsuch in 2017 and Brett Kavanaugh in 2018. Obviously, the two Trump appointees were in very different ways, quite controversial. Gorsuch, because his appointment to the court relied on Mitch McConnell being unwilling to fill Clarence Thomas's seat when he died suddenly. Wishful thinking.
Yes.
When Scalia died suddenly in February of 2016, that was a full 9 months before the presidential election and almost a year before Obama left office, but nevertheless McConnell blocked any confirmation hearings from Obama's nominee and waited until the next election. Trump is elected, and on April 10th, 2017, Neil Gorsuch joins the court. And then, of course, we had the most recent nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, and, of course, the hearings into his nomination involved the testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and her charges against him. And they had remarkable echoes to 1991, the Clarence Thomas hearings and Anita Hill. And Kavanaugh was sworn in on October 6, 2018, which was 5 days after the term started, because the term always starts on the first Monday in October. As a result, Kavanaugh did not participate in the first five arguments that the court heard, and therefore not the first five decisions, but other than that, he was there for the entire term. And finally, in the bottom row, I have a layout by ideology, although there are some uncertainties about this. The most liberal member of the court is Justice Sotomayor, by any way you tend to rank these things, followed by Justice Ginsburg and then Justice Kagan. So the left-hand of the court is clearly dominated only by the women on the court. Then we reach Stephen Breyer. In the middle, we have John Roberts. And then things get a little unclear. I've placed them Kavanaugh, Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas. There are some arguments about in what order Kavanaugh and Gorsuch should be placed. But I think it's really too early to know for sure. You really need to wait two or three terms into a justice's tenure on the court before you can truly assess where they will be relative to the other justices in terms of their conservative, liberal take on the world. This, according to Supreme Court historians, is the first time in our history that every single one of the liberal justices was appointed by a Democratic president, and every single one of the conservative justices was appointed by a conservative, by a Republican president. And that creates an issue for the court in terms of appearing to be a partisan institution. And you may remember that when President Trump criticized a justice who had ruled against the administration, he called him an Obama judge. And it was John Roberts who responded by saying, "We do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges. What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before him. The independent judiciary is something we should all be thankful for." The question, of course, that raises is what exactly did John Roberts do to try and preserve the reputation of his court as an independent body? And time will tell the answer to that question. By ideology, the Chief Justice turns out to be the median justice, the man in the middle, in terms of the liberal conservative array of the court. Sometimes, but not always, the median justice is what's called the swing justice. And until he retired, Justice Kennedy had been viewed as the swing justice since 2006, quite a long time. And what that meant was that he was the most likely of the conservative justices to join the liberals in some fairly important areas of individual rights, including same-sex marriage, affirmative action, and abortion. It's not at all clear that the Chief Justice intends to replace Justice Kennedy as the swing justice, although he may occasionally fill that role as he did in the census case. But this term, it was actually Justice Gorsuch who was more likely to join the liberals than the Chief Justice, although Gorsuch's views in general aligned him more with Justice Thomas, and they agreed 81% of the time. So it's still a little hard to figure out exactly how to categorize Gorsuch. So I know that statistics in general are not terribly exciting, but it's one useful way to look at the work of the Supreme Court. This term, the court issued 72 decisions. Most of the cases were selected from what's called the discretionary docket, which is to say cases that the court chooses to take but doesn't have to take. That's most of the filings with the court fall into that category. There were over 7,000 cases, petitions for review filed with the court, and since they took 72, that means your chances of getting the court to accept your petition was about 1%. Many apply, but few are chosen, as the saying goes. The other thing to look at is the voting patterns, in addition to the kind of number of cases. And there's a chart on the second page, description of how divided was the court in various cases. So There were, in fact, 29 of the 72 cases, 29 of them were by unanimous court. So we always think of the court as divided along 5-4 lines, but 39% of the time they reached a unanimous decision. 18% of the time it was an 8-1 or a 7-2 decision, not at all close to the 5-4 line. 11 cases resulted in 6-3 decisions, and there were 20 5-4 or 5-3 decisions, 28% of the court's docket. That number was actually somewhat higher than it has been in recent years, although not for the reason we might have anticipated, not because the five conservative justices in 20 cases lined up against the four liberal justices, not by a long shot. In fact, that lineup, conservatives versus liberals, only happened in 7 of the 20 cases. In 9 of the 20 cases, the light is red. I don't know what that exactly means. Is the mic still on?
It's on.
No.
That's
right.
It's on. Go ahead. It's on.
Okay. So in 9 of the 20 cases, the liberals got a fifth vote to form a majority. And in 4 of those 9 cases, it was Justice Gorsuch who joined them. Based, it appears, on his libertarian views, his desire to rein in the power of the government, which sometimes had him voting with conservatives, if that's what they were doing, and sometimes with liberals, if that's what they were doing. Chief Justice Roberts joined the liberal wing of the court twice only, and then the remaining 3 conservatives each joined the liberals once. Of the remaining 4 cases, there were one example of truly strange bedfellows. There was a case in which the majority consisted of Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, the 3 on the left, and Gorsuch and Thomas, the 2 on the right. And the final 3 5-4 decisions were the product of one or more of the liberal justices swinging over to the conservative side to join their conservative colleagues. In terms of voting alliances, which is also on this chart, you can see is that the closest conservative voting alliance was the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh. They voted together 92% of the time. It seems to me that what we learned is that Justice Kavanaugh, given his awkward entry to the court, decided that palling up with the chief had a lot of advantages, if that's clearly what he did. And that's followed by Roberts together with Alito at 91% of the time. On the liberal side, the biggest tag team was Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, who agreed 93% of the time, followed by Justice Kagan, who voted with both Ginsburg and Sotomayor 88% of the time. On the lowest allegiance score, of those on the same side of the ideological divide, Gorsuch voted with the Chief Justice only 67% of the time, and with his newest colleague, Justice Kavanaugh, only 70% of the time. Whereas on the liberal side, there were no significant divides on that side of the aisle. The justices were much more in agreement than was true among the conservatives. So today, I'm going to focus on 3 cases, the 3, I think, highest profile of the court's cases. One is a 7-2 decision, and the other 2 are 5-4 decisions. The 2 5-4 decisions are the partisan gerrymandering case and the census case. And they share a number of interesting aspects. First, the Chief Justice wrote the majority opinion in both of those cases. And second, in both cases, the chief was the critical vote to determine the outcome in both cases. But in the partisan gerrymandering case, he joined his conservative colleagues. And in the census case, he joined the liberals on the court. The other fact about this is that the two cases were decided the same day, and that day was the last day of the term, making for an exceptionally dramatic end of the term. This strategy of a liberal win together with a conservative win announced the same day is a favorite tactic of this Chief Justice, who has done this numbers of times before. It's a blunt, I think, it's a blunt criticism that a conservative decision by the court might otherwise receive, and similarly to blunt criticism by conservatives that a liberal decision would otherwise receive. So you give one victory to each side, and the reporting on what the court did gets a little muddy. So I'm going to start with the 7-2 decision, which is a case called American Legion versus American Humanist Association. And on the handout, there is a picture, a small picture, of the monument at issue in this case. This is a war memorial in Maryland, and it's sometimes referred to as the Bladensburg Cross because of where it's located, and sometimes referred to as the Peace Cross. It's a 32-foot cross atop a pedestal, and it was erected in 1925 as a memorial to soldiers from the area who died serving in World War I. It was initially funded with private donations raised by the American Legion. And then over time, the place where it was located became right in the middle of two heavily trafficked roads, a kind of traffic median, and the state got concerned about the safety of the location. And so in 1961, the Maryland National Park, Capitol Park and Planning Commission took over, acquired the land and the memorial, and took over the maintenance of the cross since that time. In 2012, many years after it was placed there, a lawsuit was filed challenging the presence of the cross as a violation of the Establishment Clause. And on the handout, there's the Establishment Clause is part of the First Amendment, and it is one of two provisions in what's called the Religion Clause. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The first part, the Establishment Clause, has to do with the relationship between the government and religion, and the second part protects religious liberty. So the lawsuit argued, as I said, that the presence of the cross on public land in Maryland violated the Establishment Clause. By a 7-2 vote, the court disagreed with that and upheld the cross as consistent with the Establishment Clause, and the only two justices who dissented were Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, and Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissenting opinion. One of the interesting things about the case was that there were seven separate opinions in the case. Nine justices, seven wrote separately, and six of the justices who authored opinions were all members of the majority of the court in this case. So even though they agreed with the outcome, they had a wide range of explanations for why they were reaching that result. There have long been issues about the Establishment Clause and exactly what it means. What kind of limits does it place on the government in terms of the possible relationships it's allowed to have with religion? In the earliest period where the court started to decide these cases in the late 1940s, the court took a strict separation view, and they quoted Thomas Jefferson, who talked about a wall of separation between church and state. Over time, the wall, strict separation rhetoric receded, and the court started to talk about neutrality as the necessary relationship between the government and religion. Although it turned out that neutrality was a fairly imprecise term, And various justices took different views about what it meant. Sometimes some of the members of the court thought it meant only that the government had to be neutral between religions or among religions, that they couldn't prefer one religion over another, whereas other members of the court thought that neutrality meant that the government had to be neutral as between religion and non-religion, and that the government could not favor a particular religion or religion generally, or on the other hand, could not show hostility to religion. That they had to take that middle position described as neutrality. The current court is deeply divided over what the relationship between the government and religion should be under the Establishment Clause. And at one extreme, we have, not surprisingly, Justice Thomas, who actually believes that the Establishment Clause should only apply to the federal government and not to the states, even though it has applied to the states since 1947. It should only, in his view, prohibit an established federal church and other techniques for the federal government supporting religion that force people by law to support religion. At the other extreme, there are Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor who are comfortable with the older, strict separation view of the relationship between government and religion. And in between, there are a raft of different views, though in general, the conservative justices tend to prefer an approach that focuses on history more than what we call doctrine, more than a specific test to use. Like to look at early U.S. history and some of the practices that began then and continue to this day, which show a, let's just say, more cooperative relationship between government and religion. And they point to things like Congress hiring a chaplain. Congress hiring a chaplain to recite opening prayers at the opening of congressional sessions, presidents. What's the right time now? 10:32.
Oh, can you please fix this?
I happen to have a clock. the exact time. I can even tell you what time it is in Cupertino, California.
I know, it's true. So funny.
You must have an Apple phone.
I thought you had 7:30.
Oh, I guess we can just, do the 3-hour difference.
Things like, in addition to the chaplain hired by the Houses of Congress, proclamations issued by various presidents, including early presidents, like Thanksgiving proclamations that include prayers as part of their content, and the fact that the opening of sessions of the Supreme Court includes the phrase, God save this honorable court, as well as numbers of other practices. And the conservative justices view these practices as making clear that the drafters of the First Amendment didn't intend to outlaw public recognition of the importance of religion in American life. There are, however, still some areas of disagreement about that, even among the conservatives on the court. For example, are the only acceptable references to religion what I would describe as general references to the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition of belief in a single God, or is it acceptable to show a preference for a particular denomination? Does an Establishment Clause challenge require that someone be compelled to participate in a religious activity over their objections? Or is it enough if they're offended by something that they regularly observe, like the cross in their religion case? And some of the areas of disagreement are obvious in the various opinions written by members of the majority in the American Legion case. So a considerable amount of the discussion of the various justices in their extremely lengthy opinions has to do with a test that had been used for many years to resolve these disputes called the Lemon Test. It's called the Lemon Test not because it's a bad test, but because it derived from a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman, which the court decided in 1971. And I've got the test on the handout. And under Lemon, when the court was evaluating Establishment Clause disputes, the practice being challenged was constitutional if the government could prove three things. Burden was on the government, they had to prove all three. The practice being challenged had to have a secular purpose. It could also have religious purposes, but there had to be at least one genuine secular purpose. Second, the primary effect of what the government was doing couldn't be to either advance or inhibit religion. It was okay if it did that a little bit, but not the primary effect of what the government was doing. And finally, it couldn't create what was called an excessive government entanglement with religion, which actually means something different than what it sounds to me. It sounds like it means means that the government couldn't excessively entangle itself with religion in the form of a house of worship, for example, like a joint program run by a house of worship and the government. A religiously affiliated organization would raise the same issues depending on the nature of the affiliation, or in some cases, members of the clergy. There's an important case in which a high school graduation involved a prayer recited by a rabbi invited to the school by the school principal to participate in graduation. And the principal basically gave the rabbi lots of instructions about what kind of prayer would be appropriate. And the court said, no, this is something that's unacceptable under the Establishment Clause for a variety of reasons, but it also had to do with the relationship that had been formed. So this test has been criticized more times probably than any other test the court has ever adopted. But despite being sharply criticized, and the other favorite tactic is ignored, there's a whole raft of recent cases where Lemon is just not discussed, and the court goes off and makes a decision based on history or some other approach, but simply ignores the test. But it has never been overturned. And the major criticism leveled at the test was that there's no justification for the test in the language or the history of the Establishment Clause because it wasn't intended to invalidate many of the practices Establishment Clause didn't intend to invalidate many of the practices that are unconstitutional under a strict application of the Lemon Test, that it just wasn't historically justified. Many people thought, I was among them, that when the court agreed to review the American Legion case with five conservatives now on the court, and none of them having any interest in defending the Lemon Test, that the time had finally come for the court to overrule the test, to formally put it in the trash can. But that did not happen, quite surprisingly. The court in this case sharply criticized the test. Individual justices said that it should be viewed as overturned, but not a majority of the court. Although it's very hard to imagine the court in any future case ever relying on it again, given all the comments that were made against it, but because it remains on the books, so to speak, it will be possible for lower courts to continue to use it if they want to. And they may well want to do that because the court has not really provided any substitute that gives clear guidance to the court, except in cases that are virtually identical to the Cross case. But beyond that, in the many other areas of Establishment Clause disputes, there's really nothing that they can hang their hat on, and so that Lemon may continue to be used at least at that level. So I'm going to do a brief summary of the lower court opinions, of the individual opinions in the case. So Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion, And he spent a lot of time describing the uses of crosses as a universal symbol of mourning for the dead soldiers who died fighting in World War I, and not just a symbol of Christianity. This was a view, not surprisingly, that Justice Ginsburg disagreed with in her dissent. In addition, he provided a whole list of reasons why the Lemon Test was unworkable and inappropriate when it came to cases like the one before the court. And instead, he applied what he described as a presumption of constitutionality for long-standing monuments, symbols, and practices with religious associations. So that probably means that many similar cases will no longer reach the United States Supreme Court because of the strong presumption that he established and that the majority established. However, he didn't explain how long something has to be around before it becomes long-standing. And I'm sure there'll be many fights to come over exactly where that line is. And why an identical monument that was erected more recently is any more constitutionally problematic than an older carbon copy. So that was kind of his view of things. He stuck really to the narrow question of monuments, memorials, displays on government property, and didn't get into any of the many other areas where the Establishment Clause raises where there are issues about the whether the Establishment Clause has been violated. Justice Breyer wrote a very brief concurring opinion, thankfully from my point of view, and he repeated his frequent view that no one test should apply and that you should look at the facts of the case in light of the purposes of the Establishment Clause. In this case, Justice Kavanaugh got his first try at tackling the Establishment Clause, and he viewed the majority as adopting a history and tradition approach, which he agreed with. And he also described the Lemon Test as no longer good law. And he announced his own sort of test, in which the government essentially gets three chances to win, maybe more than three. And he said that the test first required that the challenged government practice not be coercive. So that if it was coercive, that raised other constitutional problems that this test, I guess, doesn't address. And then provided three avenues for the government to win in a case of a non-coercive practice. They could win if the challenged practice is rooted in history and tradition. They could also win if the challenged practice treats religious people, organization, speech, or activity equally to comparable secular people, organization, speech, or activity. So equal treatment for religion and non-religion. And the government could win if it was a non-coercive practice and it represented a permissible legislative accommodation or exemption from a generally applicable law. So what does that mean? Well, sometimes laws, like criminal laws, are passed, but the government writes in exemptions for people who engage in that conduct as a result of their religious beliefs, like Native Americans using peyote in religious ceremonies and other kinds of practices. And so there are a fairly extensive list of these exemptions which the government has enacted. Self-employed members of the Amish religion don't have to contribute to Social Security because they don't believe in taking handouts from the government, and a whole raft of other exemptions rooted in religion. And he says those are constitutional. But then he added that that's not to say that challenged government actions outside that safe harbor are unconstitutional. Any such cases must be analyzed under the relevant Establishment Clause principles and precedents. So one difference between Kavanaugh and Alito is he is not limiting his description of what the court should do to cases involving monuments and memorials. This is a much more general approach to the Establishment Clause. Justice Kagan writes a concurring opinion. She joins the conservatives on the court, but she's not willing to abandon Lemon's focus on purpose and effect, she's also not willing to wholly embrace focus on history, as the majority does. And this is a kind of a I join you but not fully approach that she frequently uses. And it's, I think, her way to try and maybe probably unsuccessfully to limit the impact of the views of the conservative justices over time. My guess is that it will turn out to be a particularly ineffective technique with this court, and she will be forced more often to be on the losing liberal side of the aisle. Justice Thomas expresses the same kind of views as he frequently does, preferring a form of absolutism to the subtleties of traditional analysis. He repeats his view that there's no incorporation, that the Establishment Clause doesn't apply to the states. He also argues that the clause in its language only applies to laws. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, and a decision to place a memorial is not a law, and therefore it couldn't be covered by even an Establishment Clause that applied to the states. He also requires that for there to be a violation of the clause, that the behavior at issue has to be coercive. People would have to be, I guess, forced to stand in front of the World War I memorial on various occasions in order for them to have in order for there to be a violation of the Establishment Clause if they are not forced to do so by the government. And I suppose that even if they commuted generally on these roads back and forth and had to see the cross day in and day out, that wouldn't be enough because they were choosing to drive those roads as compared to getting to work some other way. He also is among the few, maybe only members of the court who have no objection to sectarian religious displays. He doesn't care if it's religion generally or support for a particular religion, as long as there's no legal coercion. And he doesn't make any effort to, like, unlike Justice Alito, to broaden the meaning of the cross into some kind of universal symbol. He takes it as a religious symbol and says that it's constitutional nevertheless. Justice Thomas also joins Justice Gorsuch's opinion. An opinion that in many ways, I think, is just as extreme as the Thomas opinion, although it only deals with one issue. He says that the claim should be dismissed because the plaintiffs lack something called standing. And standing is a requirement that plaintiffs have to satisfy in order to bring a case in federal court consistent with what's called the case or controversy requirement of Article 3 of the Constitution, the judiciary article. And it means that the plaintiffs have to show that they've suffered a sufficient injury to justify bringing suit. And in his view, being in frequent contact or seeing the cross on frequent occasions is not a sufficient injury. And therefore, the court should never have reached the merits of the case and should have simply dismissed it because the plaintiffs lacked standing. That what he calls offended observer status is not constitutionally sufficient. This is inconsistent with some earlier cases that the court decided, one involving, for example, a Ten Commandments monument on the lawn of the Texas State House, which the court upheld. But it was challenged by someone who frequently passed by the monument on their way to a legal library on the statehouse grounds, and they only had offended observer status, and the court had no trouble resolving the case on the merits, but Justice Gorsuch's view, people in that circumstance should not be able to bring these claims. He kind of argues that, oh, don't worry, there'll be some other people who have more distinct injuries that can bring these kinds of claims, although all of his examples have really nothing to do with memorials, where it's hard to imagine people being forced to be in contact with the memorial. I suppose if you were a government employee who worked there and therefore had to be there frequently, you might have the kind of injury that he's talking about, although that's probably the person least likely to sue their government employer. I think that his view of these kinds of things is really a view that would take off the court's docket many of the disputes over, or maybe all of the disputes over memorials and monuments that otherwise might come to the court. And he too doesn't limit his discussion to long-standing monuments. He doesn't care how long they've been there. And he also says that the court should overturn Lemon, which he describes as a misadventure and a mess. Finally, Justice Ginsburg writes a dissent in the case, and she pushes back against the idea that the cross is a universal symbol of mourning, and she writes as follows. The Latin cross is the foremost symbol of the Christian faith, embodying the central theological claim of Christianity that the Son of God died on the cross, that he rose from the dead, and that his death and resurrection offer the possibility of eternal life. In light of the religious significance of the cross, she concludes that by maintaining the peace cross on a public highway, the commission elevates Christianity over other faiths and religion over non-religion. Memorializing the service of an American soldier is an admirable and unquestionably secular objective, but the commission does not serve that objective by displaying a symbol that bears a starkly sectarian message. Because, in her view, the commission has endorsed Christianity, she concludes that the monument violates the neutrality required by the Establishment Clause. While the American Legion case makes clear that the court's Establishment Clause decisions are moving in a direction that allows the government to embrace religion in various ways, it's really unclear how far that will go, because this decision carefully tries to cabin the breadth of the decision, not to answer any of those questions. Despite the lack of formal overruling of Lemon, I think it's fair to say that it's a virtual dead letter with the court. Unlike one of my favorite descriptions of Lemon that comes from an opinion back in 1973 by Justice Scalia, who really did have a way with words. And he described Lemon the following way, like some ghoul in a late night horror movie that repeatedly sits up in its grave and shuffles abroad after being repeatedly killed and buried. And instead of Lemon, I think we are going to be left with some form of history and tradition approach, although such an approach is, of course, very indeterminate because history allows us to make choices. Depends on which example we want to look at, how we view the historical record. Next term, we may get some additional clarity, or maybe not, about the court's view of the religion clauses, because they've agreed to accept a case involving a very different circumstance, which is a school scholarship program that utilizes tax credits, and where the state of Montana excluded parochial schools from the benefits of the program, because of a provision in their state constitution. And the court has been asked to review and has agreed to review that. I think it's fair to say that, based on some past cases, that the court's likely to strike down the exclusion of parochial schools. But once again, the issue will be how broadly or narrowly they reach that result. So next, I'm going to talk about the partisan gerrymandering case. Yes?
Whatever happened to the idea of secular life should be protected from religion?
Well, that was, of course, one of the views of the framers, and it appears there's a disagreement about history. The conventional wisdom about the history of the First Amendment is that the framers thought that there was a, there were two levels of protection, that both religion was protected from government by the religion clauses, but also the government and its citizens were protected from religion by the government. But you know, part of the explanation is that the Constitution only limits the power of government. So if a particular religion acts alone in some way to influence the public, that doesn't involve government action and the Constitution is not implicated. It's only when religion teams up with government that the Constitution comes into play. We really haven't seen the court address the kind of issue that you're talking about in recent cases. There are some older cases involving this kind of joint venture. There's a case involving the city of Cambridge gave kind of veto power as to the location of places that had liquor licenses to nearby churches. And the court struck that down as unconstitutional because of kind of what you describe as an unholy alliance between government and religion. But we haven't really seen too many cases that raise the government is turning over its power to religion in order to allow religion to impact the lives of its citizens. And let me add one other thing. When the government acts in this case, you could argue that what they're doing is supporting Christianity. But it's the government acting. They made the choice to acquire the monument and to leave it standing. Once they acquired it, they could have broken it apart or offered it to some private donor who would accept it and move it away. I mean, they made the choice. This is really the government acting. The fact that it was private, even if it was put up initially by a church, that wouldn't matter because it's really the government's behavior that's being challenged in these cases. So partisan gerrymandering. And I think it's really safe to say that this was the most important case of the term. And it decided after many, many years of uncertainty that partisan gerrymandering is a political question. And it's beyond the power of the federal courts to resolve. It was an approach and a result that was only made possible by Justice Kennedy's departure from the court and his replacement with Justice Kavanaugh. And it's probably the most dramatic consequence of Kennedy leaving the court to date, although my suspicion is we'll have other fairly significant cases as well that will be the result of that change in the court's membership. There were only two opinions in the case, unlike in the American Legion case. The majority opinion was written by the Chief Justice, and the dissenting opinion was authored by Justice Kagan on behalf of the liberal wing of the court. So I don't know how much you know about partisan gerrymandering. It's something that I've had to learn maybe more about than I want to know as a result of this case and some earlier ones, which the court initially took and then dismissed without reaching the merits. So it's the process by which the party in power in the state legislature draws voting district lines in order to maximize their political power and dilute the power of the other party. Partisan gerrymandering. There are other kinds of gerrymandering, like racial gerrymandering, which the court has found to be actionable, unlike the result in this case. But the one that's caused the court the most difficulty is partisan gerrymandering. In general, it attempts to either create safe seats for the party in power to maximize the benefits of incumbency, in effect. And in the early days, when the parties could work together, it often protected both seats of both parties, and it just secured those seats in perpetuity for the incumbents. and prevented challengers from gaining a foothold. The other thing that it can, of course, do is to maximize the seats won by the party in power. And it, or it can try and do both things, both protect incumbents as well as maximize the number of seats for the party in power. The more extreme forms of partisan gerrymandering, which we're seeing now, seek to allow the party in power to control many more seats than the number of voters who vote for their party statewide. The two cases that came before the court were consolidated for oral argument and decision, and one came from North Carolina and the other from Maryland. They were both initially heard before what are called three-judge district courts. So instead of a single justice, the three justices were on the panel of the in the trial court. And this is a procedure that's available only in a small number of cases. And if it is available, it provides for mandatory review by the United States Supreme Court after a ruling by the district court. So the court had no choice but to take this case. It wasn't a discretionary at all, it was mandatory. The Maryland case involved district lines drawn to favor Democrats, and the North Carolina case involved district lines drawn to favor Republicans. The challenge to this kind of arrangement was brought in these two cases, and there was an argument that it violated the following provisions in the Constitution: the First Amendment Free Speech Clause, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, Article 1, Section 4, called the Elections Clause, and Article 1, Section 2. And in the handout, I've got all four of those provisions in the Constitution so that you can see what they actually say.
What was the vote on this?
5-4.
5-4.
And this one was the five conservatives as against the four liberals, so classic lineup. So this had been an issue that had come before the court before. In 1986, at a time where the court was more liberal than today, six members of the court agreed that some amount of partisan gerrymandering violated the Constitution. And was what's called justiciable, the kind of issue that federal courts can resolve. But they couldn't agree on a standard to determine how much gerrymandering is too much under the Constitution. And that inability to agree on a single standard has been a feature of the partisan gerrymandering cases that have come before the Supreme Court ever since. The court has never struck down a single example of partisan gerrymandering that it's had before it because of an inability to agree on any standard that would appear to be workable in these cases. Why is it so hard to craft a standard? Well, the task of drawing district lines is left to state legislatures. And it's the court's view that, therefore, politics inevitably plays a role in the drawing of district lines. And there's no way to imagine that it wouldn't play a role, given the fact that it's the legislature that is drawing these lines. And the question, therefore, is a question of how much partisanship is too much partisanship. Mm-hmm. And that's a question that the court's been unable to answer. This is a very old practice. And it dates back to 1820, and the term gerrymandering was coined as a result of the fact that the Massachusetts governor in 1820, a guy named Elbridge Gerry, who later became vice president of the United States, signed a bill into law that created an oddly shaped electoral district that resembled a salamander. So that's where you get the gerrymandering, and in order to entrench his political party. In more recent years, as I mentioned earlier, The objectives of gerrymandering have gotten more ambitious, and this is partly due to the result, or mostly due, to the existence of computers to help with drawing district lines, and additional data about voters that the legislature now has available to it that is more exact than the data they had in the past. And it's the combination of the ability to draw thousands of possible maps and figure out which one gives the best advantage to your party and more information about voters that makes this a much more powerful tool than it used to be. And the goal is now, as I said, to produce a state legislature and a congressional delegation where the number of seats won by the party in power that benefits from the redistricting is many more than the percentage of voters who vote for that party statewide. And to achieve this objective, the map drawers use a combination of what's called packing and cracking. So packing is putting many voters of the same party in a single district, many more than necessary in order to win that seat. And so many of the votes are therefore essentially wasted votes. They're not necessary to the outcome, but they are taken away from more competitive districts to give the party in power a better chance of winning in those other places. So we have packing on the one hand. And then we have cracking. Where voters are taken away from a district won by that party to replace them with voters of the other party and to therefore flip the district. Mm-hmm. So let's say we take Democrats out of a district that was in Democratic hands but by a reasonably close margin, and we replace them with Republican voters and we swing that seat to the Republicans. And the removed voters in that arrangement are either moved to a PAC district or to a district that's solidly under the control of the other party, and therefore their presence won't make any difference. Here's an example of this, that's what happened in North Carolina, and this is a description from the brief filed in the case by Common Cause. And they said, the 2016 North Carolina congressional plan is the most overt and likely the most extreme partisan gerrymander this court has ever seen. The official written criteria that governed its creation expressly dictated pursuit of partisan advantage for the Republican Party and specified a quota of 10 Republican districts and just 3 Democratic ones, despite a near equal split among the state's voters. To implement this directive, the map drawer admittedly packed as many Democrats as possible into 3 overwhelmingly blue districts and cracked the remainder across 10 red ones. The heads of the Joint Redistricting Committee, appellants here, publicly declared that the plan enshrined into law their view that electing Republicans is better than electing Democrats, and acknowledge that the plan is a political gerrymander. So this ability to create a large difference between the statewide percentage of votes won by a particular political party and their numbers in the congressional delegation and also in the state legislature is the result, as I said, of the fact that computers can quickly draw many alternative maps and the legislature can pick the one that's the most favorable to them. In 2018, for example, Democrats won 48% of the popular vote in Ohio, but only 25% of the US House seats. In North Carolina, Democrats won 50% of the popular vote, but only 23% of the US House seats. In Georgia, Democrats won 48% of the vote, but only 36% of the House seats. And these lopsided results are the result of partisan gerrymandering. And today, as people have argued, instead of voters picking their representatives, representatives are picking their voters. So despite this distortion in the electoral system, the Chief Justice concluded that courts had no power to address this issue. He declared the issue to be a political question, rendering it non-justiciable, beyond the power of the federal courts. So this concept of justiciability comes from an interpretation of Article 3 of the Constitution, the judiciary article. It's the first constitutional provision on page 3. And it's a description of the extent of judicial power, and it describes the way in which this power extends to all cases and controversies of various kinds. And it's a way that federal courts essentially limit their own power, and they can only decide, for example, cases that involve adverse parties having a real stake in the outcome of the case. That's the standing argument that Justice Gorsuch made use of in his opinion in the American Legion case. It means that the case has to be timely. It can't be either too premature or too late. And it finally means that the question can't be a so-called political question. This last requirement was, of course, an issue in Brucho, but it turns out that the political question requirement, that it not be a political question, has two components. One is that the issue is that the court is being asked to resolve is left to the complete discretion of one of the political branches of government, to the Congress or to the executive branch, by language in the Constitution. That there's simply, in the constitutional text, no role for the court to play, and therefore it's a political question. That has been used as the basis for decisions in numbers of cases. The other, rarely if ever used, and I think perhaps the answer is never used, is that there are no, what the court calls, discernible, manageable standards that can be used by federal courts to resolve the constitutional dispute. And it was that second explanation for the court's unwillingness to wade into this controversy that the Chief Justice relied on at Brucho. So the political question justification, in one of its forms, I went back and read the early case, and it seemed to me that there's an argument that it was the first kind, that it was left to the other branches of government, but there are arguments both ways. It was used to avoid federal court involvement in a battle, in a previous battle, at another time in our history, over whether electoral districts had to include the same number of people living in them, the so-called one-person, one-vote requirement. And there was a time period between 1900 and the 1960s where state legislatures didn't even redistrict after a census every 10 years. And so there were significant distortions in the number of people in various congressional districts, so that there were twice as many people, for example, in some congressional districts as compared to other congressional districts. And this was challenged in the federal courts. This, of course, dilutes the power of someone's vote if it takes twice as many people are voting for a single representative in some districts as compared to others. And the argument was made that this violates the Equal Protection Clause, that each voter's vote should count the same. And there was an early time when, in fact, the court ruled that this was non-justiciable, that it was a political question. But then in 1962, in a case called Baker versus Carr, the court changed its mind about this and said that it could intervene in such cases, although it didn't lay down standard. That happened 2 years later in another case called Reynolds versus Sims, where the court set out a standard to use in reviewing equal protection challenges to violations of the one person, one vote requirement. In her dissent in the gerrymandering case, Justice Kagan argues that the extreme partisan gerrymandering that's going on now is also a form of vote dilution, just like the failure to allow people's votes to count equally by numbers. And that the court should prevent it, just as it did in the one person, one vote controversy. The Chief Justice, by contrast, discusses the one person, one vote cases and says that those were controversies that were much easier to resolve because they were about mathematics. Whereas the gerrymandering cases raise many issues that focus on providing some kind of fairness, although it's not exactly clear what kind of fairness, because we don't have a system of proportional representation where a party is entitled to a percentage of the seats in the legislature that equals their percentage statewide. That's not our system of government. And so that can't be the objective, that mathematical preciseness can't be the objective in the partisan gerrymandering cases. And he says that basically none of the parties, none of the other members of the court, and none of the many experts who testified in the trials of these cases have offered a standard that he thinks is both workable and reliable. And as a result, he concludes that it's a political question that should be left to the other branches. He also then, to kind of soothe people who might be upset, offer some suggestions for other mechanisms that could be used to reach this problem. One of which is state courts that could resolve these disputes because they're not bound by the case or controversy requirement. Although Justice Kagan asked the question, well, if the federal courts can't figure out a standard, what makes you think the state courts can do any better? He also mentioned state constitutional provisions, Congress under its power under the Elections Clause, independent redistricting commissions as some other choices. Justice Kagan, I've given you some language from her opinion on page 4 of the handouts, which I'm going to allow you to, page 3 to 4. Some language from the Chief Justice's majority opinion about talking about why there's no role for the court of, from an unelected and politically unaccountable branch of the federal government, and Justice Kagan talking about the fact that these cases deprive citizens of the most fundamental right of their constitutional rights, the rights to participate equally in the political process and to join others to advance their political beliefs. Alex, I thought I had, am I wrong, to 11:30? That's...
So,
oh, my watch stopped working. Oh, wait a minute. It's 11:18.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Okay. I want my next 12 minutes.
Actually, you lost a few minutes with the...
Well, I did, but I'm not going to ask for those back. I'm going to be generous. So that, I'm going to start by using those 12 minutes to talk about the census dispute. The census dispute.
Right.
So Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, announced the plan in March 2018 to place a citizenship question on the main census form. And this, of course, made many people fear that this was discouraged people from immigrant communities, even if they were citizens themselves, from filling out the census form, which would mean fewer people counted in large cities where immigrants tend to live, and also in states like New York and California. There were lawsuits filed, two of them, and they argued that this practice would violate the enumeration clause of the Constitution, which sets down the requirement of a census every 10 years. And the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act, or APA as it's called for short, which kind of tells the government the way in which it's supposed to reach decisions, and the Fifth Amendment Equal Protection Guarantee. So as it turns out, the most powerful of these arguments, once the case gets to the United States Supreme Court, is the argument about the APA. While the restrictions it imposes on how the government reaches decisions are not very severe, nevertheless, the court requires that they not act in an arbitrary and capricious manner, and that was the standard that got them in trouble in the case before the judge in Manhattan, the major case that the Supreme Court reviewed, and also the Maryland case as well. So one of the things that the Trump administration does all the time is to try and get its litigation to the United States Supreme Court as quickly as possible, to bypass what it considers to be less friendly lower courts. And it did this twice in the censorship case. The first time had to do with a dispute over whether the record in the case could be reopened for additional evidence. The challengers argued that the government hadn't told the full story, that there were discrepancies, and that they had to supplement the record. They wanted to question both Secretary Ross and also the acting chief of the Civil Rights Division, and the government objected to that, and they brought their objection right to the Supreme Court, and they said, you know, please stop this. The court kind of temporarily stopped the testimony of Ross, but allowed the other fact-finding to continue, and they agreed to place this question on the docket in a speedy way, and so the court agreed to hear arguments on the evidentiary issues. They acted on November 16th, and they scheduled the case for argument on February 19th, which is a kind of extraordinary short timeline, because the government was always arguing that this kind of an emergency, they have to get the census forms printed. They can't allow this dispute to go on forever. By the time the court granted review in November, the trial before the district court had started, and it ended shortly after the government granted review to review the evidentiary issues. And on January 15th, before the argument, Judge Furman issued his 277-page decision. And he barred the government from including the citizenship question on the census. The district court pointed out that it had not appeared on the main census form since 1960, which was the time when the government for the first time divided the census forms into a short form and a long form. Before that, there was only a long form, and there were also census takers that went door to door and questioned citizens. In 1960, they got rid of the census takers, and they used these forms, and they replaced the one long form with a short form and a long form. And the citizenship question has never appeared on the short form until the decision by the Trump administration. In looking at the record, Judge Furman concluded that Secretary Ross had committed a veritable smorgasbord of classic clear-cut violations of federal law governing administrative agencies. And he also made clear that he had not used any of the new evidence that had been introduced to the record. He only relied on the original record. So after that, the challengers asked the government to dismiss the case about whether Ross could testify, because it said it no longer mattered because the case had been decided without his testimony. And the court agreed. They basically canceled the argument in the case. And then shortly after that, the government said, well, you have to hear the challenge to the district court's decision immediately. You can't wait for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. We gotta get right to the Supreme Court. And because we have to start printing the 10 census forms by the end of June. On February 15th, the Supreme Court agreed to expedite its review of the case. The case is fast-tracked. An oral argument is held on April 23rd, at the very end of the argument schedule of the term. And the court's presumably going to decide the case by the end of June before it goes out of session. Now, ordinarily, after the oral argument, nothing happens in a case while we await the Supreme Court's decision. But that wasn't true in this case. Instead, what happened was that new evidence came to light after the death of somebody called Dr. Thomas Hofeller. His papers and electronic records were reviewed by his daughter after his death, and new evidence revealed that Hofeller who was an expert on redistricting, had played a major role in adding the citizenship question in order to create a structural electoral advantage, as he wrote, for Republicans and non-Hispanic whites, and that the government hid his role by affirmative misrepresentations. The government had argued that the citizenship question was requested by the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice in order to help them enforce the Voting Rights Act, because as we know, they're very interested in protecting the rights of minority voters. But the information from Dr. Hofeller showed that he had really talked to the Department of Commerce and had talked to them about adding this question, and that it was the Department of Commerce who had asked the Justice Department to tell them to ask the question for Voting Rights Act enforcement, and that Dr. Hofeller had actually drafted some of the memo that was eventually sent by the Justice Department. This new evidence was used in the New York case to ask for sanctions against the government for lying to the court in its explanation for why the question was answered, and in the Maryland case in which the equal protection claim was being litigated and was then on appeal to the Fourth Circuit. 2 days before the Supreme Court decision, the Fourth Circuit ruled that the plaintiff's claim of discriminatory motive for the Commerce Department's decision could go forward. And the plaintiffs in the New York action before the court made several findings to the Supreme Court to try and alert the court to these new developments, which put in question the explanation which the court had been given for why this had happened. The government, in a new act of, and this is not a legal term, what I would call chutzpah, alerted the court to the Fourth Circuit decision and asked the court to also rule on the equal protection question, to take it out of the hands of the Fourth Circuit, even though it had not been briefed and argued before the Supreme Court. We'll never know if the disclosures influenced the court's decision released on the last day of the term. So in this decision, it looks great for the administration. The Chief Justice rejects a whole slew of arguments based on various provisions, based on the enumeration clause, based on the Census Act enacted by Congress in order to implement its power under the enumeration clause, even rejects essentially some APA arguments. But then, after seeming like the government's about to win, in fact, the Chief Justice in Section 5 of his opinion says that the request by the explanation for the request by the government was pretextual. And it's clear now from the record that the request originated not with the Department of Justice, but with the Commerce Department, and that for effective judicial review, it's necessary that the Secretary's explanation be the real reason for his actions, even if not the only reason. And that, he says, our review is deferential, but we are not required to exhibit a naivete from which ordinary citizens are free. And so what he did was, finding the explanation not credible, he told the district court to remand to the Department of Commerce to supplement the record with evidence of presumably a different and more credible reason. So, after, of course, that happened, chaos kind of reigned. The Commerce Department said it was going to print the forms without the question. Then President Trump announced that he was still trying to get the question in. And eventually, he made a statement which said that they weren't going to include the question, but they were going to provide as much information as they possibly could to the states from other sources in order to give them information about citizenship. And he specifically said that that was so that the states could decide whether to count non-citizens and others who are not permitted to vote, such as children, in their redistricting efforts. So this is where, and I know that time is up, but I want to just explain this. This is like the Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain. As it turns out, the citizen case and the gerrymandering case are closely related to each other. And they both have to do with distorting the results of elections. In the Constitution, just one more minute, in the Constitution, it talks about counting people. It doesn't talk about counting citizens or only counting people eligible to vote. It talks about persons or people. But there's an argument floating in conservative circles, including from Dr. Hofeller, which was really what he was aiming at, which is that the states are allowed to only count some people, people eligible to vote, not children, not non-citizens, perhaps not felons. I mean, we don't really know how long this list is. And that they can do their vote, they can pick their voting districts based on this self-selected population. And that, of course, will vastly diminish the power of Democrats, who largely fall into these categories. If you look at the demographic data, immigrants tend to have the most children, et cetera. And so you get rid of children and you get rid of immigrants, you make the, as Dr. Hofeller said, you make the voting population, you make the districting population much more Republican and much whiter, which benefits Republicans. And so this is where the two claims come together. I expect what will happen is one of the states will now do exactly that. They've been sort of instructed by the government, that's what you, one of you should do. And that issue will come back before the Supreme Court. And that will be a more explosive issue than anything to date. I'm going to stop here. And I know you have a break and then other, yeah.
You know the idea of proportional representation?
Yes.
To be approved by the state?
Yes.
Do you know how I can find out the progress of that, what it's called?
I should try and look it up after class and try and figure out, I don't know exactly where it's data about that. There are some cities which use such a system for their city councils, for example, and I guess there's a rule.
The idea of that is to have enough electoral votes. Electoral college votes.
That I know about.
Yes. What is it called? So I could follow.
I looked at their website a number of times. That's a little different than this, because that binds each state to vote for the president, not who won their state, but who won the popular vote. And it doesn't become effective until enough states have agreed to it to win an electoral majority.
Get rid of the electoral college already.
But that would require amending the Constitution. That's not going to happen.
Let me just say, if you're coming to the next session, you do our act. And if you're coming to the next session, it's in the Midrash room where the hockey team is. And
But on the other hand, they've always been counted.
I'll give it to you and you give it to me.
I'm not concerned.
Are you happy with that?